I'm Larry Collins. Those of you that don't know me, I wear this around my neck all the time because that's part of my trade. I teach geology at Cal State University, Northridge, and I teach mineralogy, and when students come up to me and say, "What is it?" My eyesight has gone so bad now that I have to take my hand lens out to look at them. And this other device is a magnet, and some of the minerals are magnetic, so I check to see whether it's magnetic or not. So that's what I wear around my neck. And as people up here come up and ask me, then I've got tools of trade to handle it. The title of this talk is "The Christian Geologist Looks at Creation." I felt the necessity to put this talk together after I had gone to a school conference where the school was a private school, and they brought teachers from several different communities of this private school where they had different schools to come in to have a workshop, and all the different kinds of teachers were asked to try to show how they could apply Christ to their classroom. It was a Christian school. And they couldn't find anybody to come in and talk how Christ could be put into the classroom for science. Somebody at my particular church, and I happen to be a Methodist, was teaching at the school or knew of me and said, "Would I come do it?" Well, I found out what kind of school it was, and I was a little hesitant because I thought my theology would be different from theirs. But I thought about it a bit and decided I would go and be a missionary to this school, knowing that what I would probably say would be in opposition to what they were wanting to teach, and give them a chance to hear another side, I hoped. Well, it turned out as I made my presentation, it wasn't soon until they were suddenly aware that my theology was different from theirs, and they wouldn't let me finish.
Oh, really?
They were soon jumping up to put their side of the viewpoint and to stand up and to quote Bible verses to show that their view was right and I was wrong, and so we had an interesting time. I was very gentle because I realized that I came in on a situation that I wasn't really what they wanted to hear. Soon after, I got invited to another church of a different denomination in which there was somebody who believes in a literal interpretation of the Bible, who had taught in previous years a creation science view in Sunday school classes at adult level, and it so angered some of the people in the congregation who happened to be scientists, and that they thought that there was another view. And when this man wanted to repeat the thing, they wouldn't let him do it unless somebody would come in and put the other side of the story. So I came in, and he didn't know what my views were entirely, but he wasn't going to allow me to have equal time. He took one night a week for 4 weeks. I got the fifth week, and then we were supposed to be a panel to answer questions from the class on the sixth week. Well, I was supposed to be a theistic approach to it and look at evolution from a geologist's point of view
against the state.
Down everything that he'd said in the first 4 weeks with a different point of view, and it wasn't what he had expected at all. I did not convince him, and I have a feeling that what I have to say is not likely to convince any of these kinds of people at all. They have a viewpoint which is such that their whole faith is dependent upon a literal interpretation of the God of the Bible. And what I have to say just is entirely opposite of that. So I'm also aware that some of you may have this view and you may totally disagree with me. And I hope that you do, because then we can have a good discussion. Part of my effort is not to reach these people, but it's the kind of people I have to deal with at the level where I am as a college professor, and I'm dealing with people who are highly trained in science, who have been turned away from Christianity, who often, many of them, are either atheists or agnostics, who have an intellectual approach to religion and the Bible and creation, and they just can't take this other view based on their own background. And I would like to share with you today some of the problems that they have with the Bible, some of the problems that I have with it in terms of literal approach to it, show you the negative qualities that these people are looking at, but at the same time, when I'm done, I want to give you a positive answer. So it isn't all negative, and there are ways of looking at this that have a positive way of looking at it. So hopefully you'll hear me out and not jump up and give me problems like the other people have done, and then I can finish, and then we can have a good discussion, and maybe you can help me to see ways that I could reach out to people who do have problems with it. All right. In a recent poll, Gallup poll, it was discovered that nearly half of the U.S. population believes that the Earth is 10,000 years in age. Now, that's a little startling when you realize that that many people
have what percentage
this, nearly half or over half believe that the Earth is 10,000 years in age. And it's this approach to this, it's the reason why there's a great effort to put their viewpoint into the school systems in terms of science, and that they believe that it was created as Genesis has said. These kinds of people call themselves creation scientists. They want to apply science to interpreting the Bible and show how science confirms what the Bible says, and it's a literal approach, and they believe that the Bible is an authoritative answer to all questions, including science, and it cannot be questioned. Let me show you now, if we apply science to the Bible, what happens. Would you read the first five verses of Genesis for me there? And we don't have time to read all of them, but at least it'll give us a start.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and the darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good, and God separated the light from darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning one day.
We could go on, and you know how the story, you've read it many times, and there's always an evening, or a morning, and an evening, and the second day, and the third day, and so on. These people would say that day there means exactly what it says, a 24-hour period, and they would interpret it as such, so that God did his creation in a six-day period of 24 hours each. But how do you measure a day? Isn't it when the sun comes up and when it sets, and so that you have an evening? If you go on to read through Genesis, you'll find that the sun isn't created until the fourth day. How in the world do you measure a morning and evening for the first 3 days unless you have the sun there? And so if you look at this from a literal sense, from a scientific sense, it doesn't make good sense. They only take that data which will apply to their theory, and then they ignore what doesn't apply. You will find that in Genesis 1, the heavens are created on the second day, and that the earth is created on the third day. When you go to Genesis 2, both heaven and earth are created on the same day. And so the two different creation stories don't agree if you make that kind of a literal interpretation. If you go to Genesis 1, verses 11 through 16, you'll find that the sun and stars are created after the plants. And then in the second chapter of Genesis 2 and 5, they're created before the plants. So the two different versions don't agree. These people are very capable of rationalizing this, and they have an answer for it, but they have to rationalize in order to do it. If we make a jump to the New Testament, I know you're familiar with it, with this verse in Matthew 5:13, "You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltness be restored? it is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trodden underfoot by man. As a scientist looking at that, if I make a literal interpretation, it says that salt can lose its taste. And as all chemists know, salt doesn't lose its taste. No matter what you do to it, it's always salty. So if you interpret this from a literal scientific sense, it makes no sense. However, I don't think Jesus was trying to think in terms of a literal science. He was giving his disciples an example of how one needs to witness. And using a metaphor, and I think probably the way that this can be interpreted so that it does make good sense for you, and let me just give you an example here. In the time in which Jesus lived, there were basements or shallow places that they could store their wine and keep it cool, and they had nothing but dirt floors. Salt was a very important item in that period of time, and they were often stored in bags, and they were also kept in cool places there. But in the coolness, salt has the ability to draw moisture and to make things wet, and it wouldn't be long until those bags got damp. The containers would rot. First thing you know, the salt would spill out on the floor, and it would get mixed with dirt, and it wouldn't be fit to use for food, and it was only fit to throw away with all the dirt in there, and so it would lose its savor. It would lose its desire to have it on food with all the dirt that was mixed in. And I think what Jesus was saying there, if you don't use your salt and you just store it, then it has no value to you. If you don't go out and witness and share the meaning of Christ to people, then your witness is not worth anything. And so there are ways of looking at this that makes good sense, but you don't have to put a literal interpretation on this passage and make it try to fit science. Okay, let me just spend some time now with you and take a look at the idea of the age of the earth as these people would interpret it. Of a six-day creation versus, as I would suggest, that the universe and the earth involve billions of years of time and not just 6 days. Let's take a look at the evolution of life, which is a problem for these people, and in terms of one of the things that they object to is the idea of man evolving from the apes, for example, which they find very offensive. And let's also jump beyond Genesis and go to the story of Noah's flood, which is also a problem for many people. The idea, at least in as they would interpret, of a total worldwide flood that would cover the earth completely up to the very mountaintops. Okay? The concern to make a literal interpretation in, I think, around the 16th century, it may have been the 17th, I don't have it in my notes here, there was an Irish bishop named Bishop Usher. You may know about him, who felt that the Bible was a complete record of the complete history of the earth, and that if you went progressively back in time looking at the genealogies and put them together, so-and-so begat so-and-so and so on, totaling up the time, that he could work his way back until he could say exactly when the earth was formed. And by doing this, he said that the earth was formed in 4004 BC on October 22nd. I think he even specified 10 a.m. in the morning. I don't remember exactly what it was. Some wag has said, was that standard time or daylight saving time? So if you take that figure plus the time that we have now, that makes the earth no more than about 6,000 years in age. And this has been recorded in many early Bibles on the basis of Bishop Usher's determination. Scientists, in looking at stars out into space, and I'm not going to go into the method, they can take variable stars and measure the light coming from them. They can actually find distances to these stars, and calculating the speed of light in which these things come from there, they can calculate that these stars have to be billions of years away, and therefore the light has been traveling for billions of years of time, and they can say it has to be, the universe has to be at least that old for allow for the light to come in. I, as a geologist, in the laboratory, you can take rock and melt it up and let it cool to harden to form crystals that you could get in rock, and you could measure the cooling rate of the heat that's necessary to cool it down to form a rock. And when you take something the size of the Sierra Nevada in California with the huge masses of granite there, and take the cooling time it's necessary to cool that huge mass of rock when it formed at great depth, the only conclusion that you can reach is that it took 5 billion years, or 5 million years, or 10 million years for this to cool off to form the crystals. Contrary to this, of course, the creation science people will say that God created instantly on the whatever day it was created, okay, and formed it in place. There are all kinds of dating techniques that scientists use and radioactive dating methods. And each of these different methods all give similar ages, and they will produce ages of very long periods of time, much beyond 6,000 years. I'm not going to go through those methods. They could be understood by you if we took the time to talk about it. But for most people, this is sort of a black box thing that they don't understand, and I want to give you some ideas on that you can think through naturally, and that seems reasonable, that will show you that the Earth is much older than 6,000 years ago. For example, out in the South Pacific, you can find coral growing there on some of the atolls, and these corals put out fronds and fingers, and they're very beautiful, and they grow a few feet below the surface of the water. And they have to have sunlight in order to grow. They grow no far faster than about a half an inch a year. Maybe in the best ideal conditions where you've got food coming in, they might grow as much as 2 inches a year at most. But most of them are far less than this because it isn't ideal conditions. The waves coming in on these coral reefs that are there break up these fronds and fragment them and grind them down into a sand, so that from the growth of that, you couldn't make more than maybe less than a half an inch of sand a year out of this, because it's just fingers that are sticking up. From drilling on some of these coral atoll reefs, and these corals have to grow in shallow water, we find that they're over 4,000 feet of coral sand that's there. This means that at some time in the past, that which was at depth was up near the surface where it could have sunlight, and the island that formed it was slowly sinking, and as it slowly sank, the corals grew on top of it to keep up with it, and the rate was slow enough that as the waves beat it up, it created sand. Okay? Well, if you've got more than 4,000 feet of this sand there, that's more than 50,000 inches, and if the average rate of accumulation of sand is only a half an inch a year, then you've got at least 100,000 years of history there to build up all of that sand that's there. In 1054 AD, the Chinese recorded a supernova explosion in the sky in the Crab Nebula. This was recorded in history books from the time that they formed, and through the centuries since then, astronomers have been looking at this spot where the supernova explosion occurred, and they can see an expanding ring of explosive material that's been blown out in space. And taking photographs of this year after year, they can calculate the rate of expansion of that ring of gas that comes out from that star. They can then take that rate of expansion without ever knowing that there was an explosion occur and calculate when it was once together in one spot. And when they make the calculations, it comes back exactly to 1054 AD. Okay, and so they can use science to make this measurement. Then they look at another place in the sky, and it's in the Cygnus loop, and they can find a similar ring of gas that's expanding out in space from a point. When they calculate back to the time when this ring was back together, turns out it was 60,000 years ago when that occurred. So if we are to believe that science is accurate and you can use these kinds of things, then something must have happened 60,000 years ago, and that's much beyond 6,000 years ago. Let me use something that's probably even more familiar to you, and that's using tree rings. You know that trees have one ring of growth per year, and the thickness of that ring is a function of the climate. If it's dry, it's a very narrow ring. If it's a very wet year, you have a much broader ring. In California, in the Panamint Range, up around 10, 11, 12,000 feet, there are what we call bristlecone pines there. They grow at the very highest elevation. Their rate of growth is very slow because it's cold. It's also on the desert side of the Sierra Mountains, and there's not much moisture, and so the amount of growth is very tiny. But because of its height and its coldness and dryness, the trees that are there don't decay or disappear. They just stay for years and years. Somebody came up and climbing it up there and discovered the trees, decided to put a drill core through there and pull off the core and see how old these were. Some of these date back to the time in which Christ was here. They are so old. Some of them around 4,000 something. I've forgotten just what the oldest that they found. But by looking at the tree rings and so on from these trees that are now living, and then using other tree branches that have fallen off from earlier ones, they can put these things together and say this connects to here, and this is a bit older, and this is where it matches up. They can put a template of tree rings that go back to 8,200 years. There is a gap of missing trees that they haven't found yet, but they have found trees that they can use with carbon-14 dating that go back from 9,200 to 10,000 years ago. And so they've got a record of trees that at least live that long. Finally, we talked about glaciers earlier in the week, and there's evidence of glaciers coming down from Canada all the way to the southern tip of Illinois. Not only once, but at least four times that we have evidence for this. And in between those glacial periods of time, there's enough time for soil to develop on the glacial rock that got pushed down, and trees and forests could grow on this. And then the glacier came over the top of it and buried it and repeated this over and over again. In order to get ice thick enough so that it will flow across a flat surface, from Canada all the way down the southern tip of Illinois, you have to have ice at least 18,000 feet thick so that the pressure of it will cause it to move out across the continent. If you're going to put this four times with that, at least that average thickness there, and it may have been as much as 50,000 feet thick in Canada, then you're going to have to have a rate of snowfall about 200 feet per year in order to get it into that time span. And in order to melt it back down, you're going to have almost a blowtorch climate to melt it fast enough to get it to back to disappearing. So these are the kinds of problems that you face when you try to make a literal interpretation in terms of the age of the Earth. Now let me take a look at the life that we find on the Earth. In South Africa, in the Karoo Formation, which is just one small formation worldwide of different kinds of rocks that are deposited, you can find reptile bones, fossils that are preserved there. And there are so many of them that if you average out how many could be in that whole formation, you come up with 800 billion animals that are preserved as fossils there. Some of these are large animals, some are very tiny, but on the average they're about the size of a small dog. In Siberia, you can find tusks of mammoths that are there, and so many of them buried in the tundra that's there. There must be at least 5 billion mammoths that are buried in the tundra. If you take all of these different kinds of fossils that are present there and assume that they were living at the time of the flood that destroyed the Earth, and this is an assumption that these people make, is that there was no death until the flood came, and all of the deposits of fossils represent the time in which the flood went over these living animals to bury them. If you take 800 billion of these reptile fossils and distribute them as living animals across the Earth, over the whole Earth, in an area from here down to the building, in other words about 1 acre, about 208 by 208, you would have 6 reptiles sitting in there. If there was actual oceans and you just had continents to put these on, then every single acre of the earth in which land was exposed would have 21 reptiles on it per acre. Okay? That doesn't sound too bad, does it? But I've only picked one formation. If we take all of the other formations that also have vertebrate fossils in them, and assume that this represents only a hundredth of the potential vertebrate fossils that could be living at that time, and a hundredth is very conservative, then you now have 600 vertebrate animals living per acre that are competing with Noah's cattle that are growing there, okay? Or maybe 2,100 vertebrates living on that acre. That makes it a little bit less plausible now, doesn't it? But geologists know that usually fossils are not preserved completely when things happen. Remember how many millions of bison or buffalo were growing out across the plains of the United States. We think that probably on the average 1 out of 10,000 animals are preserved as fossils. The rest, because they're exposed to the elements, they oxidize and disappear, and it just happens on a chance situation and the animal gets buried or it's preserved. So now if I multiply 600 by 10,000, I've got 6 million animals per acre, or 21 million animals per acre that were living there at the time the flood supposedly buried them. So if you really apply science to the situation and see what it really means, it becomes very implausible that what we're talking about. Then if you go to the animals that are in the ocean at the time, and these would be the sponges and the clams and this kind of thing, and calculate how many animals are living at the flood that are preserved now as fossils there, you have to have the sponges and clams covering the whole earth a foot and a half deep. And how in the world are you going to feed all of these animals on the food source in order to do this? So you can see if you apply science to the situation, it begins to be ridiculous. One of the real problems that people have in terms of evolution is the so-called missing links. Where is the missing link from all the steps of the creation? And they always throw that at geologists or anybody. For example, the first bat that we find in the geologic record looks like a perfect bat. There doesn't seem to be any transition point. You find this first bat fossil, and then from that time on you do see the bat evolving into slightly different species up until the present form. But where is that transition form from the animal that came before the bat that made that transition? Incidentally, if you go to Deuteronomy 14, verses 11 to 18, let me ask you, is a bat a bird or a mammal? Do people know? It's a mammal, isn't it? Guess what the Bible says it is? It says it's a bird. You look it up, that's exactly what it is. They classify it as a bird. There's a mistake, if you allow our present understanding, but you'll have to remember that people in that time were not scientists. That which fly, that flew, was a bird to them. So, at any rate, let me try to show you that geologists really expect not to find missing links. There are some cases where we do find progressive changes all the way through, but not always. The first dog that appeared, we call Timarchus, and it appeared about 15 million years ago, if you believe the time scale that I'm talking about. And from this particular dog, there evolved the wolves and the coyotes and the foxes and the jackals and the dingoes and the wild dog that came. If you come through time, you'll find that the early cavemen and the American Indians and certain primitive tribes in China and some of the Egyptians would take some of these wild dogs and they tamed them and used them as hunting creatures to help them go out and hunt. And through time, they began to breed these animals to develop characteristics that would help them in their hunting process. And from early cave time up until the Christ lived, there was developed 17 different breeds of dogs as we know them. From the time of Christ to the 1500s right now, an additional 22 different breeds have been developed by artificial breeding processes. And from the 1500s to the present, there are an additional 75 different breeds of dogs as we know them. So that we now have a total of 115 different breeds of dogs. For example, we have the Great Dane, the Bulldog, the Collie, the Mexican Chihuahua, we've got the Cocker Spaniel, and the Greyhound, and the Skye Terrier. And I can't remember what your dog is, mostly.
It's kind of like Duke's mixture, or Cocker Scandal, I guess.
Cocker Scandal, okay. Anyway, let me ask you, where is there preserved in the geologic record all of the missing links to show how all of these different breeds have preserved? Where are the fossils of all of these different animals that you see preserved? In order for to show how each one of those are related to each other through the progressive time, you've got to have some, one of those animals has to get so abundant that he's everywhere. And when he gets so abundant, then there's a chance possibility that some catastrophic event occurs that happens to catch some of them and bury them. It might require a landslide to come down the mountain and catch a bunch of them. It might find a volcanic explosion to come out, so volcanic ash settles down. It might be a catastrophic flood that comes down and washes them somewhere. But even after you bury them, there's no guarantee that the animal is going to be preserved as a fossil, because if oxygen gets to it, it'll decay and totally disappear. Or even if it is preserved, there's no guarantee that we're going to find it, because sometime later erosion may come down and erode it out and it's gone. So there may be all kinds of missing links of steps of animals that have evolved and they didn't quite fit, and we'll never find the missing links. It's only when it got so well adapted that it grew in great abundance that the chances are of it being preserved. There, and I need to make the point here, that not all animals have totally evolved through time. There's a whole bunch of animals that when they first formed, they were able to adapt to conditions, and they have not changed through time, but have been preserved all the way through. And there's no missing link. It's the same animal all through the geologic record. The chambered nautilus, the tuatara lizard, the horseshoe crab, the sequoia tree, and the ginkgo tree. These have stayed and they've not changed. There's no missing link. They've come right on through. Okay. Let me now just move quickly to Noah's flood and take a look at that. Noah's flood was supposed to have occurred after a rain of 40 days and 40 nights, you know the story. It was supposed to be so extensive that it covered the whole earth up to the mountaintops. There's some real problems of this for me if you take this literally in terms of the geologic record. If you look at the sedimentary rocks that have the fossils in it, layer upon layer around the world, there's supposed to be the sediment that settled out of this flood. You could find in the midst of these layers, which have fossils in it, sedimentary sandstone layers which have sand grains in them that are frosted. Frosted like the light bulbs that you have from impact. They take the glass and they impact it with sand to frost it so it scatters the light. Sandstone that's been deposited in water is not frosted. It's smooth and round where the grains have been rolling and rubbing against each other in the liquid water that's present there. But sand in the desert, when it blows, impacts with in collisions, and where it impacts, it chips out little chips of sand there and you get a frosted surface. So you get huge thicknesses in the midst of these so-called flood deposits that could only have formed in the desert. Not only that, in layered within these, sometimes you get huge masses of salt deposits that can have only formed where there was a large body of water that evaporated, and the evaporation allowed the salt to concentrate to the point where it crystallized. So in the midst of these huge flood deposits, we've got desert sands and chemical precipitation of salts and gypsum and all kinds of crystals that form only from the evaporation of water. That doesn't make any sense, okay, if you're dealing with a flood that produced these. The people who believe in creation science take great delight in trying to show evidence in the fossil record that man lived back in that period of time. And there's a place down in Texas along the Pluxey River where you can find huge footprints of dinosaurs. And they're so large, the footprints, that a small boy could take a bath in the print. And you see the three toes that are also there. And you can see them plodding across the flats there. Right beside it is what these people have interpreted as the footprints of a giant man. And there were supposed to be giants that lived back in the early age. And these footprints are, oh, I guess, maybe 18 inches or 12 inches long, something like that. They're large. And they plod right beside the dinosaur footprints, and they have a stride of about, oh, 7 or 8 feet. So, and they can see this, and they say that they can see the heel and the toe prints, and it looks just like, they point to these and say, that's where man lived with these giant animals back in that time. But when you look at the footprints, you discover that where the arch should be, that the arch is not on the inside, but it's on the outside. You also discover that if that's the case and you got it mixed up, that the guy's walking with his left foot over here and his right foot over here, and that's kind of crazy. You can also discover that some of the footprints somebody has chiseled in the toes and the foot in order to make people err, so that they've cheated a little in order to make them look like footprints. Because if you put your foot down in the mud, and I know you as kids have walked in the mud, and the mud squeezes up between your toes, and you can see the flow lines, the mud up between there, but when you look at the chisel prints there, you don't see any flow lines coming up, so you know it's a hoax. Somebody there, the track tourists, artificially put these in, so some of them are hoax. Not only that, when you look at these things carefully, geologists have suggested that really what you're seeing is a smaller reptile. And the reptile was probably browsing or grazing in shallow water in a lagoon area. And the smaller animal beside him, he got into deep water and couldn't quite reach bottom. And so he was swimming a little bit. And you get the claw marks coming down and impacting on the mud there to make the footprints that look like a giant man that's walking, and you can see where the claw marks as they come up out of the water duck up where the heel is. Not only that, now it's been shown in recent years, within the last 2 years, erosion on these along the Pluxey River has eroded down, and some of these things that look like footprints are now beginning to show three toes. So it is just as they've said, it's not a giant man there, but actually the footprints of another dinosaur. So they're going to have to abandon using that as evidence that man lived there. But not only that, they're using the same unit there to show that life lived there, but it's the same unit that they're trying to use to predict that the flood occurs and cause death, because that same rock unit has the fossils of dead animals in it. And you can't simultaneously use that rock unit to say this is the time when people lived and ever had free airspace above it, and at the same time say this is the rock that's underwater that's being deposited in which the animals die. And so they've got real problems with that. Okay.
Where was this?
Pluxey River in Texas. Also, if you have a flood, the flood comes with such rushing force in it doesn't have time to sort animals out, and you find that worldwide you have primitive forms at depth in the layers, and as you go up through the layers you go from primitive fish and that kind, and then you go to amphibians a little higher up, and then you get to reptiles and mammals, so that there's a sorting in terms of life as you come up through this flood. if you take something up and shake it up in the water, it turns out that the heavy stuff will settle to the bottom and the light stuff will come down last and be on top. There's no sorting in terms of bones in which heavy, big bones go to the bottom and lighter bone stuff come up to the top. You find all kinds of animal sequences in which the heavy bones are at the top of the sequence and anywhere in the sequence where you have big animals. There's a problem here in Washington, for example, along the Columbia River. In places you used to be able to see until they put dams in and dammed up water behind them, sequence of lava flows, one on top of each other, 20 of them. And between each of the lava flows, after the lava came out and cooled and hardened, there was enough time developed that a soil horizon formed on top of the lava flow. It weathered to form soil and trees grew on it. And there was a forest over the top of it. After that occurred, a new eruption of lava came over and came over the top of the forest and buried the trees there and preserved them as petrified tree stumps of that old forest. Then that lava flow cooled and hardened, and then there was enough time for a new forest to grow. Well, you get 20 different forest horizons between lava flows, and it takes a long time for the lava to cool and harden in the first place with great thicknesses that were there. How in the world can you get trees to grow underwater in a huge flood and do this 20 different times? And these lava flows have fossil deposits above it, and they have fossil deposits below it, presumably deposited there by the flood. Let's talk about the ark and the animals that were supposedly taken on there two by two. There was a German Jesuit priest called Athanasius Kircher in the 17th century who took all the mammals and all of the birds and all the snakes and reptiles that he knew in Europe at that time. And on the basis of the size of the ark that's recorded in the Bible, he reasoned that the ark on that basis was about 450 feet long. It was about 75 feet wide, probably as wide as this building across, and that there were three different levels in the ark, so that the total height of the ark was about 45 feet. Okay. Using those dimensions and taking all the animals that he knew, he was able to design rooms to put all of them in there. And he actually had three rooms left over for storage and food. He actually had space for Noah and his wife and for his three sons and his two wives. And it made pretty good sense. He had 130 different kinds of mammals, he had 150 kinds of birds, and he had 30 kinds of snakes. And that's what he had learned in Europe and had seen. Since then, we now know that there are over 3,500 different kinds of mammals worldwide. There are 9,000 different kinds of birds. There are over 5,000 different kinds of snakes and lizards. And this does not include the millions of different kinds of fossil animals that he wasn't even aware of in terms of the dinosaurs and in terms of the huge mammals, so that you're dealing with several million different kinds of animals at the present. And the Bible requires that all living things be taken on two by two. If you, in this, the mammals that I listed there includes about 40 times as many large animals that this Jesuit priest wasn't aware of. If you take all of these animals that were supposedly living at the time and put them on the ark two by two, you have less than a half a cubic foot per pair to put these all on there. Okay? So if you apply a literal interpretation to this, you've got real problems. Where did all the water come from that caused this flood? If it rained for 40 days and 40 nights, and it rained enough to cover the whole mountaintop and the whole earth to this depth, and it came down from clouds up in space, in order to hold that moisture in space there, you've got to get it, the air is so hot to contain it up there, you would have cooked Noah to death. Okay? If to form rain in a cloud, to condense it from its gaseous form to a liquid form, you have to lose 80 calories of heat per gram of water. And that heat is released in that process. The release of that heat during the condensation, to do it in 40 days with that quantity of water, would have cooked you. If you say it didn't come from there, but it came up from great depth in the Earth's surface as it boiled up out of there, as you go down in depth, the temperature increases and gets hotter and hotter. In fact, if you do a drill core down in depth to where we pull oil out, you may not realize this, that the oil comes out at boiling temperatures. It's so hot down in depth, it increases about a degree centigrade, I've forgotten how fast, but increases at a very rapid rate. So if you go down to any depth to get a quantity of water that you need to get out of the space down there, the temperatures get up to 1,600 degrees centigrade. So it would come out at boiling temperatures. If you bring it in from outer space as a comet coming in, and bring it in to bring that quantity of water in, it would have come in maybe as a large chunk of ice out in space and impacted. And the impact would have been so violent that it would generate steam clouds coming up. So if you do this in terms of science and figure out what would happen, it doesn't make any sense. Okay. Well, let's sort of back off now and begin to get some positive look at this. I'm just about there. I've probably knocked the pinions out of many of you, maybe at this point, have never heard this viewpoint before. I think our problem is that we tend to think like Greeks and be very scientific, and the Bible was written by Hebrews, and we need to think Hebrew. We need to think like the Jews. Numbers, exact numbers, were not nearly as important to these people as the symbology of the numbers. And when they say it rained 40 days and 40 nights, they may not necessarily mean 40 days and 40 nights, but it rained a lot. And we want to precisely put it down to that period of time. If you go to the region in which the flood likely occurred, that Noah may have experienced, you have in the geologic record preserved there are many examples of floods through time. So there must have been a flood story that existed, and there are examples of floods of coming. And even today in that region there are floods. I guess within the last 10 years there was a timing of a hurricane with a great force that came in exactly at maximum high tide, and normally tides only come in a certain distance, and you had this huge flood come in with the tide, and it went inland over about 250,000 people, and they drowned. Believe me, they've got a flood story to tell about, and it will be a part of their record and history for ages to come about that huge flood. Worldwide, as you go around the world, I'm told that there are 80 different cultures and tribes which have a flood history. And supposedly this is now used to say this represents, way back in the past there must have been a huge flood that covered the whole earth. But in California, at Mount Wilson, just north of Pasadena, they have the world's record for the amount of rainfall in 1 minute. In 1 minute's time, they had 2 inches of rainfall on top of that mountain. And by the second minute, they had 3 inches of rainfall. They had a flood there when that thing came down. I was talking to somebody last week, and he said, down in Louisiana, or it was Texas, I'm not sure, a hurricane came in and wasn't too powerful, but it just sat there and rotated. In a 24-hour period, they had 23 inches of rain. He said he was lucky that the rivers and the water began to rise up the street, and it just got up to where it was just about to inundate his house. He's got a flood story to tell. Periodically, they have what they call the 500-year rain down in California, in which it just rains and rains and rains, and everything just floods, and they put in reservoir dams to, when that happens, they can catch this water so people don't get flooded out. So there are local catastrophes where floods do occur, and in some cases, this flood could drown and kill a lot of people. And when that happens, they've got a flood myth, a flood story to tell them that. All right. Methuselah lived to 900 and some years, right? We immediately think Greek and say that's 900 years as we know it. But if you think Hebrew, very few people lived to very old ages. And the older they got, the more they could remember about the past, which the young people who only lived 10, 12 years, maybe died because of sickness, or maybe 20 years. These people that lived to longer periods of time became very wise because they could remember back to an older time. The older they got, the wiser they got, people became very reverent toward these very old people, and to emphasize how wise they were, they added length of time to their ages. I'm just suggesting this, I don't know. But someone under 900 is very wise, and it's their way of saying this is a very wise man. We have adjectives and adverbs that say very and this sort of thing, but the Hebrew language doesn't necessarily have this. And so we think Greek, and when we say 900, we translate it as 900 years as we know, but it could have been 90 years if they lived, and that would have been a very wise man. Okay. Let me give you another example before I get to some positive aspects. There was an idea developed by Ptolemy, who was an early astronomer. His idea was that the Earth was the center of the universe, and that Mars and Jupiter and the Sun and the planets circled around the Earth in perfect circles. Objects up in space was where God lived. That was supposed to be perfect up there. If you were on Earth, you were less perfect, and anything down below was where hell was, okay, or the bad was. Things on Earth were bad, things up there were good. There was a contrast between good and evil, hot and cold, whatever, tall and short. There was always a contrast between those kinds of things. Anyway, the Earth was the center of the universe, and the objects up in space moved in perfect circles around it. Well, as the early astronomers watched these things, sometimes the planets, as they went across the sky, seemed to move in certain through the constellations. Sometimes they appeared to back up through the sky and then turn around and go forward again. The only way they could account for this was to have the planets moving circles and then have the planet up here moving in a circle around the circle, so that as it moved forward, sometimes it looked like it backed up a little bit before it went on. Okay? Well, they began to discover, as they began to watch these through the centuries and centuries, that with these kinds of predictions, they could tell when eclipses would occur and where the planets were to be, but sometimes it got a little bit out of phase, and so then they had to put a circle on a circle on a circle to make the thing fit. Well, it wasn't long until Copernicus, who was another astronomer, came along and suggested maybe this idea isn't right. Maybe the Earth is not the center of the universe, but it's just another planet that goes around the Sun. And if you do that, then sometimes the Earth is inside of the planet up here, and sometimes it passes up these others, and so the other planets look like they're backing up as the Earth goes around a little faster than one way out here, and so you can account for it. But the Church accepted the idea that the Earth is the center of the universe, and this became dogma with the religion at the time. And then Galileo came along. And Galileo, with his telescope, began to look out into space, and he began to look at the moon and discovered the moon wasn't just a nice silvery disk up there. It wasn't perfect. It had blemishes on it. It had mountains on it sticking up. That wasn't too good. And then he began to look out in space at Jupiter. And lo and behold, there was Jupiter, and it had four moons going around it. Four more than the Earth had. The Earth had one moon, and Jupiter had four. Well, that wasn't supposed to be at all. And he called his friends in and said, come look and see. And they said, oh no, you might be witches and we might see those four moons. Okay? So there was a big objection to it. But Galileo said that really Copernicus is right, and that really the Earth is in the center of the universe, but the Sun is just another planet that goes around the Sun, and he began to get in trouble with the Church. And the early creation scientists of that time said, the Bible is right, and you're wrong, because Psalms 104, verse 5 says, thou didst set the earth on its foundation so that it should never be shaken. The earth was solid. It wasn't moving through space around the sun. And they could argue with him with pure logic. That is, if you say the earth is just another planet going around the sun, then in order to get a day and that is a morning and an evening, it must mean that the earth is rotating. Okay? It isn't the sun moving across the sky, it's the earth that's turning. And if it's turning this way, then it must be going at enormous speeds. And as you people are sitting there right now, you're going about 900 miles per hour right now. Okay? If you're going that fast, wouldn't it be if I threw this pen up in the air like that, that the earth would turn out from underneath it if it's going that fast? Right? It didn't go out from underneath it when I threw it up, did it? Can't be right. And if you say that the earth is going around the sun in its orbit, in order to go that distance around, it has to be going 100,000 miles per hour right now as you're going through space. And if you're going through that space that fast, it would have to be giant winds blowing and just blow you right off the earth's surface. Do you feel any wind right now? So they say, haha, you must be wrong. The Bible's right. The earth can't be shaken, okay? I don't know of a single creation scientist that would believe a literal interpretation of that right now. We've got too much evidence that the earth is traveling around the sun and it's spinning on its axis. Okay? So now they have to rationalize this and discard this and say that the Bible's not right. Okay, a few more and then I'm going to let you people talk. Let's take a look at what I think the purpose of the Genesis 1 and 2 stories are. I agree with Conrad Hayers, who's a theologian who published a book in 1984 called The Meaning of Creation, Genesis, and Modern Science. And he suggests that Moses, when he lived and wrote this story, was trying to face a problem that he faced at that time. It wasn't a question of science at that time. He wasn't trying to describe an exact story of creation. But he had a problem because the tribe of Israel were surrounded by tribes of people that worshiped idols. And these people had a story of creation that would explain why they were there. And in this story, there were all kinds of gods. There were water gods, there were darkness gods, there were plant gods, there were sun gods, there were moon gods. Every single one of these gods they had to worship. And all of these gods were out to get them. And they had to bring sacrifices and do everything they could to keep from being taken care of. And in this myth story of creation by these people at that time, you will find in that myth an exact sequence of things that are talked about as in the sequence that you find in the Genesis story. Out of the void and the depth, and you'll find that these gods would marry each other and they would begat so-and-so, and the sun and moon would marry and they would begat so-and-so, and you have a complete sequence, an exact sequence that you find in the Genesis story. Not only that, at that time, the emperors and the kings were gods too, so that these had to be worshipped as well. What I think Moses did was to give these people a confidence booster to show them that they had one God and that these different kinds of things were not gods at all, but were physical objects that were made by this one God, and he created them, made them good. Okay? The sun and moon were not gods up there that they had to fear, but special kinds of physical objects that their God made, their one God, and he created them and good, and they needn't be afraid of them. And so they had the freedom to go out. When you understand it in this sense, not an attempt to show you an exact scientific creation, but to answer a problem that the Israelites had, then you can read this and look at the spiritual value and the beautiful story that's present there and really benefit from it, but you don't try to make it into science. Okay. I personally believe that there is a God and a creator, and that he's a great God, and that he's not out to fool us. He's not, hasn't made the rocks to look old, billions of years old, just to fool us out there. He hasn't created the stars out in space and simultaneously created the light coming from them at the same time to get here so that they will be younger than 6,000 years in age. Otherwise, if they're way out there in space, people back in time should slowly begin to see the sky getting brighter and brighter as more starlight comes in, as it arrives from different places out there so far away that it takes a while of light to get here. But nobody through time ever records new stars appearing or whatever out there, except they do see an occasional supernova. But there, it wasn't only recently in time that they discovered new things. I mean, it just wasn't supposed to happen. Everything was supposed to be created, and suddenly a supernova occurs that wasn't supposed to be. I mean, God isn't creating now, according to these people. Okay. I don't think it's in the character of God to tell us a lie. If we know Jesus, we know God, right? And as I understand Jesus, he isn't about to tell us a lie. He's going to tell us the truth. If you've seen me, you've seen your Father. In John 8:32, he says, "The truth will set you free," so that we could be free to study and discover these things and be set free by it and to be in awe of a much greater creator than presently people are going to try to limit us to. Jesus also told us that we can do greater works than he, so that we have the freedom to study and to learn medicine, to learn how to prevent leprosy and to do genetic things and to produce better crops and do all these great things. In Matthew, Jesus says, "Ask and seek and knock." If you read that Bible verse, it doesn't tell you what you're going to find or seek. You have the freedom to search and find new truth and not be afraid of what that might be. Best advice you can give a research scientist: knock and seek and see where truth will take you, but don't let it be limited to a literal interpretation of the Bible. I think we've been given two books to read: one, the Bible, which is a real answer to our spiritual problems and how to live, and the other is the book of nature. Both of those have to be interpreted in ways that we can understand. Both of them will change in time as we get better understanding and see where it leads us. And as we go back and our Bible scholars begin to find out more and more things, our ideas about the Bible will change. But both of them reveal a God that's so great and so big that I can't be limited to the smaller God that some people want me to believe in.